Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. On today's episode, Dr. Diana Doe of Stanford University joins the program to discuss how she applies clinical trial data for proliferative diabetic retinopathy and diabetic macular edema to her practice patterns. We also discuss suprachoroidal corticosteroid therapy, as well as her career and her shifting from multiple academic institutions. As a shameless plug, we will be conducting a first-ever online content for ophthalmologist course teaching marketing and education tips. This will be at the American Academy of Ophthalmology annual meeting on October 29th, Monday, at 4:30 p.m. in room N136. The panel will include Drs. Rahul Khurana, Steve Christensen, Osiwoma Obugo, and Matthew Weed. I will also be on the panel, and we will cover it all in 1 hour. Please don't miss it. It should be fun and educational, and we appreciate the support. Anyone who loves the podcast, please come out and support us. If you have any questions, you can always reach out to me directly. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Diana Doe. Dr. Doe is currently professor of ophthalmology at the Byers Eye Institute at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. Dr. Doe, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
So you're a new guest, and all new guests get the same question, which is helpful to all of us, especially our younger listeners, our residents, our fellows. So tell us a little bit about your career. So when and why did you decide on ophthalmology and then on a career in retina?
I think ophthalmology was the perfect choice for me because it combined surgery with a very active clinical practice that allowed the establishment of long-term relationships. And particularly, I found a passion in retina because I saw so many challenging cases in retina and so many grateful patients when I was a resident at the Wilmer Eye Institute at Johns Hopkins. I started my training at Johns Hopkins for both my ophthalmology residency, and then I stayed at the Wilmer Eye Institute for my vitreoretinal fellowship as well. After completing that, I stayed on the faculty at the Wilmer Eye Institute for the next 6 years and rose to the ranks of associate professor of ophthalmology. I was also fortunate to be able to be the head of the retina fellowship training program, and that gave me a unique perspective in the education and training of the next generation of retina surgeons. After my time at the Wilmer Eye Institute, I had the privilege of then being recruited by two other institutions, and I'd love to share that information and aspect with you and our other audience members.
Yeah. So yeah, and you mentioned you've been at multiple places. You've moved from place to place in your academic career. Tell us a bit about the pros and the cons. I mean, I know there are obvious pros to moving from an advancement perspective, from more perspective. Cons, obviously, from a family and life perspective, not easy to move, pack up, get a new home, everything. Tell us a little bit about that aspect.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of exciting aspects of moving to a different academic institution. And as you mentioned, there are, challenges as well. I was very happy at the Wilmer Eye Institute and had great colleagues and mentors there. But a unique opportunity arose when I was recruited at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And actually, I moved there along with my husband, Dr. Kwan Dom Nguyen, who is also a professor of ophthalmology. And we both decided it was an exciting opportunity for new leadership positions. And we just dove in headfirst and moved to the Midwest. It was a great experience there for 3 years. We met new friends and I think learned new aspects of ophthalmology leadership that we had not had the experience of before. But, it's always challenging when you move mid-career. you have to reestablish all of your clinical research and, you know, patient base again. So it takes a lot of effort. It's not like you just move into a position and everything is automatically perfect for you. So I think if you are deciding between staying or moving, you have to know that you can't rest on your laurels when you move. It's almost as if you are excited about moving to a new place, but yet you're ready to roll your sleeves up and work even harder to recreate what you already had and make it even better. So it takes about at least a year, if not more, to really build your practice again and then build the infrastructure for my other passion, which is clinical research. After 3 years at the University of Nebraska, both my husband and I were recruited by the Byers Eye Institute, Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. And it was also an exciting opportunity, but we knew that, you know, having gone through the change of institutions before, that it was going to take effort again. And although, you know, I came in at a senior level as professor of ophthalmology, I'm still building up my practice a year later, and I'm still building up the infrastructure for the type of research I'd like to perform here. So I think it's not for the faint of heart, but it is an exciting opportunity when you can move, work with new colleagues, and, you know, have different leadership positions.
You know, and to finish up on this topic, because I'm curious, again, as someone who is in an academic institution now for 2 years, I'm very happy, but, you know, we have lots of people in my generation who are at their first job and maybe their last job, depending on how things work out, but how does that process work, right? So when I've talked to people who have changed jobs, it's not necessarily that they were looking at the time or they're open. I mean, how does that conversation arise? Where is it that an institution reaches out to you and then you start weighing your options? Are you actively looking? Is it more just kind of a meeting of, you know, you're maybe looking to advance and then something comes along and it just works out? Like, how does that process work when, again, you're still busy and employed and maybe happy at your current job? As you said, you were both happy at Wilmer and Nebraska.
I think that a lot of these great positions, some of them aren't necessarily advertised, and a lot of it is through your network of friends and colleagues. At these prominent institutions, a lot of times they'll reach out to the individual and, you know, assess your interests because they're looking to add faculty members who can bring different beneficial aspects to their academic mission. I think what I hopefully brought to the Byers Eye Institute at Stanford is a more experienced senior level of retina leadership that could complement the existing faculty there and also serve as a mentor to some of the younger surgeons on our faculty. So a lot of it, I think, is through networking and connections and friends reaching out to each other to work together.
Right. Well, you know, and you mentioned one of the things you had to do was kind of rebuild your base of patients, rebuild your base of research patients, your projects. And you've been involved in so many clinical trials in your career. Let's talk a little bit about some of the topics that, you know, one of the things people have talked about is should we be rethinking diabetic macular edema, proliferative diabetic retinopathy? We have protocol S and protocol T results. We have updates on the protocol S results now with 5-year follow-up. How do you incorporate all this into your clinical practice? And how does all of this influence what you recommend for a patient, for example, who presents with PDR and no DME or PDR with DME? And how often do you employ, for example, PRP laser or focal laser?
Yes. I think the area of diabetic retinopathy and diabetic macular edema has been so exciting over the past 5 years because we now have so much evidence-based data to guide our decision-making. When I trained at the Wilmer Eye Institute, we were just exploring the use of intravitreal anti-VEGF agents. And during my early training years, focal grid laser was still a mainstay of treatment, which, you know, now for our new residents and fellows, it's very rare for them to do focal grid laser. So I was, you know, one of the early investigators who were examining aflibercept in phase one clinical trials, or, you know, ranibizumab as well. I think the key now is we finally have agents that can really alter the course of diabetic retinopathy. These agents are so powerful, they not only eliminate diabetic macular edema, but they can reverse the diabetic retinopathy severity score. And I think that's a big game changer. However, with all this new data, I think it also tells us that we might need to change our practice patterns. That is, we shouldn't wait for people to develop proliferative diabetic retinopathy before we start implementing anti-VEGF therapy. Now, I am actually using intravitreal VEGF inhibitors to treat severe non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy, even in the absence of diabetic macular edema, because this is the only medicine we have that can reverse the retinopathy damage. So I'm actually treating patients earlier because I want to modify their disease course, and, you know, they change the course of their disease and prevent vision-threatening retinopathy from developing.
Right. You know, and then again, what, you know, there's been studies, there's a study presented at ASRS recently, kind of real world data showing that there's a significant attrition, for example, for proliferative diabetic retinopathy patients, where many of these patients are lost to follow up and come back. There was a recent WILL study published looking at, for example, that these patients are following up, you know, sometimes, you know, 30-40% of these patients were lost to follow up. And that makes it even tougher, right? Because the clinical trial data, a lot of times, the follow-up tends to be better in that population than the real world.
Sure, that is an excellent point. You can't really just use anti-VEGF as the sole treatment for all patients. You have to individualize the approach, and certainly figuring out if the patient is compliant and able to follow up is a key factor. If a patient isn't the most reliable or can't follow up routinely, then you have to think about using other modalities. And so I still employ panretinal photocoagulation in certain patients, and I think that will always still be a mainstay of the treatment of PDR because of the fact that not all patients can follow up. And we so far know that you still need ongoing treatment to prevent the retinopathy from ultimately progressing if the diabetic disease is not under good control.
You know, and switching gears, another trial you've been involved in is the ClearSide set of trials looking at suprachoroidal corticosteroids, and this has been applied in some phase two trials for both retinal vein occlusion, also for uveitis. Tell us a little bit of your preliminary thoughts on suprachoroidal steroids. Is this something you think will be viable, and then how you see it evolving forward? Obviously, we need to wait for the phase three results, but just kind of a preliminary glance at what you think of the technology.
I think the suprachoroidal injection is a very exciting new development because we're delivering therapies to a new space in the eye. One of the potential benefits of the suprachoroidal delivery is allowing the physician to deliver a large amount of medicine that will spread to the posterior segment of the eye and possibly limiting the side effects that could be present with intravitreal delivery. Certainly the early phase 1 and 2 results from the suprachoroidal injection of triamcinolone to patients with different types of retinal vascular disease, particularly retinal vein occlusion, have shown benefit and safety. So I think this is a new technology that deserves further investigation.
Finally, you start at the beginning referenced your roles as the fellowship program director previously, and just last thing, I love talking about this because this is something we all experience if we're in a fellowship training environment as faculty. Advice for fellows who are operating, but more importantly, advice for attendings who are staffing fellows maybe early in their careers. What have you learned in your experience in terms of staffing fellows from a surgical perspective?
I love teaching, and it's very exciting to help young surgeons learn about the complexities of vitreoretinal surgery. And I think one of the most exciting aspects of each week that I work here at Byers is my OR day, because that's when you really feel that you're having such a huge impact on their training. I think I approach it like many other experienced surgeons, and how my mentors taught me at the Wilmer Eye Institute, which is always, you know, sitting by the fellow, guiding them, but letting them have as many hands-on experiences as possible, and, you know, giving them appropriate encouragement to have the confidence to do more. And I'm a firm believer in, you know, giving them early hands-on experience, because I think in surgery, the more you do, the better surgeon you are. As a fellow, I think the key is showing the enthusiasm and dedication to being the best that you can be. Always being prepared for the OR, and doing everything possible to make the clinic and the OR day run smoothly for the entire team. I think fellowship is just a brief 2-year period to learn all of retina surgery, so working hard and giving 120% every day is essential in your learning to become a lifelong vitreoretinal surgeon.
Last thing before you go, there are a couple of retinal physician couples, and you're in one of them. Talk a little bit about the difficulties, maybe some of the benefits of having a, you know, a partner in life who is also a retinal surgeon.
Yeah, I never thought I would marry someone who would be in the same medical specialty as I, but fortunately, it's worked out in a terrific manner, because we have been able to share both our professional and personal lives together, and of course have a lot of friends in common. It's also been unique because we have always been at the same academic institutions, but yet have had our own individual identities, and I think that's very essential to the success of our careers, that we are seen as individuals who just happen to be in the same surgical subspecialty. It's been exciting to collaborate together on projects, but yet also have individual research interests as well. And my husband, besides being a retina surgeon, also has a keen interest in uveitis, and he's a fellowship-trained uveitis specialist. So that has complemented his career and also distinguished it from my career, which has been more focused on vitreoretinal diseases. So I encourage people, if you happen to find a spouse or significant other who is in your same specialty, don't be afraid. Embrace it and continue establishing your own identity while enjoying the aspects of sharing your career and professional life and personal life together.
Well, Dr. Doe, thank you so much for joining us on the, from the West Coast. I know you're very, very busy. And I look forward to seeing you at Academy, hopefully.
Yes, thanks for including me, Jay.
Have a wonderful day. Thank you.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 135 episodes can be found there, sorted by category. Yes, 135. You can listen to older episodes on the website or in your iTunes app. You can find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. Contact us on Twitter at RetinaPodcast, or contact us by clicking on the contact link on our website, or email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Feedback's great. Please give us feedback on episode ideas, what we're doing well, what we can do better. This is our last episode before the AAO annual meeting. I will be in Chicago Saturday night through Tuesday morning, so it'll be the 27th through the 30th. So if you see me around, if you want to say hi, if you want to talk, please feel free. I don't bite, and I'm happy to talk about the podcast or other things. And I look forward to meeting you all out there. Many thanks to Dr. Diana Doe for joining me, Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Vinicasa, Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, articles you read and publish in, and the conversation you inspire, and for listening. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.